Penguin Random House Audio presents The Strategists. Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, Mussolini, and Hitler. How war made them, and how they made war. By Phillips Payson O'Brien. Read for you by Justin Price. For Payson, may you know as little as possible about war. Introduction. Strategy, War, and Personality. On October 29, 1941, as Adolf Hitler picked at his ostentatiously simple vegetarian dinner and sipped his favorite fizzy mineral water, his mind raced. He could taste victory, the greatest triumph in military history. German troops had just captured almost 750,000 Soviet soldiers around the city of Kyiv, the last of a series of smashing defeats inflicted on Joseph Stalin's Red Army since the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union on June 22nd. From his Spartan, bug-ridden headquarters in East Prussia, codenamed Wolfschanze, Wolf's Lair, Hitler saw the unfolding campaign as confirmation of his own genius. Only his daring and strategic vision, he believed, could have brought his nation to this precipice of victory. Soon, Germany would have a massive new empire in which to settle genetically healthy Germans while wiping out anyone or anything that stood in Hitler's way. With ideas cascading in his head, Hitler had taken to giving long monologues to hand-picked military officers and political cronies who sat obediently at his dinner table. On this night, Hitler's guests included Günther von Kluge, a Prussian-born field marshal whose military service had commenced in 1901. Von Kluge was commander of the 4th German Army, one of the most powerful forces attacking the Soviet Union. As Hitler well knew, even as the German army as a whole was winning battles, some senior commanders were worried that these victories were drawing their troops ever further into the unconquerable vastness of Russia, threatening to buckle the entire German logistical system. Major problems were appearing for the Germans on both rail and road. Since the days of Tsarist Russia, railway lines in the Soviet Union had been built with a wider gauge than those of the rest of Europe. Knowing this, the Germans had hoped to capture Soviet rail cars to keep supplies moving forward as quickly as possible. Soviet forces, however, withdrew almost all their locomotives as the Germans advanced and destroyed as much railway infrastructure as they could. Thus, the Germans were left with the laborious and time-consuming task of rebuilding the Soviet railway system to run their own trains and keep up their advance. It slowed their pace considerably. The Germans were also running short of trucks. On paper, the German army was one of the most advanced in the world. The troops that invaded Russia were carried in 600,000 motorized vehicles, but it was a motley force, drawn from across a conquered continent, and needed a wide array of tires and spare parts, to say nothing of fuel, to keep going. There were far too few German-made military-grade trucks. The backbone needed to supply large, armored breakthroughs and maintain a constant tempo of operations. As the German army struggled with both rail and road control, supplying troops scattered across a 1,000-mile front was becoming a logistical nightmare. With trains stymied and trucks scarce, the Germans were forced to take long operational pauses to allow the supply situation to be rectified. Hitler, however, did not seem concerned. Mobility, he insisted, was overrated. It's the infantryman who, when all's said, sets the tempo of operations with his legs, he informed his audience that night. He instructed them to focus on providing more and more firepower to the army to allow the German soldier to blast through any enemy and stop worrying about moving too quickly. After all, in the choice between mobility and power, the decision is given too easily in favor of mobility. Adolf Hitler's confidence was rooted in a conviction that he understood modern war. After all, he was no stranger to the battlefield. As a corporal in a Bavarian regiment, Hitler had spent almost all of World War I on the Western Front. Serving mostly as a dispatch runner, He was wounded during the Battle of the Somme in 1916, and in 1918 was temporarily blinded by a British mustard gas attack. Such experiences had physically and psychologically scarred millions of soldiers, but Hitler looked upon the war as the most wonderful and meaningful experience of his life. Prior to the conflict, he had been a drifter with no prospects. The German army and the war gave him purpose, and he devoted himself to both, reveling in his newfound sense of direction. World War I also stamped him indelibly with strategic ideas he would bring to World War II. One of them was that firepower and armored protection were more important than speed and mobility. As a soldier, he had marveled at the largest German howitzers and mortars and became convinced that heavy steel was the way to victory. When, in 1918, he first came across tanks, adopted by German forces in response to the British Mark I, Hitler quickly found the preference for the biggest and strongest over the fastest with the longer range, hardly a surprise for a foot soldier in a trench war. As he told his audience in 1941, in the trenches he had learned that only the heaviest and most thickly armored tank had any value. As a dictator, he took this prejudice and forced it on the modern German army. The next year, during another evening monologue, Hitler boasted how he had overruled those who insisted that light and fast vehicles had value, and after a hard struggle, I imposed my will and ordered the manufacture of heavy tanks. Hitler's fetish for the heaviest and most powerful, and his disinterest in mobility and logistics, had a major impact on how World War II developed. The German armies, which he created and threw into battle, were woefully short of light vehicles and trucks, while large and inefficient investments were made in building ever heavier and more powerful tanks. Indeed, German industry developed some of the most awesome and complex tanks in the world, including the Panther, the Tiger, and the Behemoth Tiger II, known to Allied troops as the King Tiger, whose heavy armor and massive long-range gun gave it a fearsome presence in combat. Yet the sheer size and technological complexity of these lumbering fortresses meant that Germany could only manufacture a small number of them when compared to the more robust and speedier Allied tanks. The stress Hitler placed on German industry to produce heavy tanks meant fewer resources to build trucks and other support vehicles. As a result, German troops were chronically short. The Wehrmacht often relied on horse-drawn vehicles to keep itself supplied and moving. The German army may have had a great punch concentrated in a few armored units, but there was a surprisingly weak body of foot soldiers supplied by horse. As Hitler was pontificating in late October 1941, he was about to receive a lesson in the consequences of this lack of mobility. A month later, the German army would fail before the gates of Moscow, its advance halted by supply problems, exacerbated by a Russian winter and a Red Army counterattack. Hitler, however, refused to learn from this lesson, and instead doubled down on his own perceived brilliance and understanding of war. Because of his fixation on power over speed and his refusal to adapt, within a year, the German army would be on the defensive in every theater of war. 2.5 years after that, Hitler would shoot himself while completely immobile, entombed in a concrete fortress hidden deep below the streets of Berlin. The central role that Hitler played in determining German strategy throughout the war, with his particular prejudices, irrationalities, and fundamental errors, does not fit easily into how we see grand strategy making or foreign policy making in general in a modern state. There is a widespread discussion in militaries, governments, and universities that likes to see strategy as emerging from a linked process of ends, ways, means. In this Clausewitzian world, strategic choice is seen as the pursuit of a clear political end through the employment of the means available to a state, such as its military force, in certain well-thought-out methods, the ways. It seems logical in theory, but as Hitler, and indeed all the dominant grand strategists of World War II, demonstrated, it's typically a mirage. In many cases, that is because strategy, grand or otherwise.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?